Good. Good. Thank you very much, Radar. And I have to correct you in one regard. Unfortunately, I'm not the president of the Health Impact Fund because that fund doesn't yet exist. I'm the president of the little organization that tries to make it happen. So, but I wish I were the president of the Health Impact Fund because that would mean it would exist. Okay, so your word in God's ear. Everything else was good. So let's start with some very simple considerations about competitive systems. Modern societies are pervaded by competitive systems, adversarial systems. We find them in the economy where businesses are competing, in financial markets where banks and investors are competing, in politics where parties and politicians are competing, in international relations where states are competing, in courts where lawyers are competing, in the media where different newspapers and television stations are competing, and so on. And competition is something that, as economists say, is a very good thing for eliciting the best efforts of people. Competition basically means that those who do better than others get rewarded more highly. And so, essentially, if you have a competitive system, you get people trying harder to do the kinds of things that we want people to do, or organizations and so on. Now, this will work particularly well when the competition is properly framed, when people get rewarded for whatever it is that we want them to do and to do well. Proper framing means that the rewards that the players are seeking from the system are highly correlated with what is of social value, with good outcomes. And that in turn requires that the rules of the game are appropriately designed so that they reward the kinds of things that we value, and that also the refereeing, the application of the rules, is done well so that these rules are administered in a way that's transparent and impartial. Now, competitive systems have one very general flaw, and the general flaw is that you can get ahead in a competitive system in two quite different ways. One is by working very hard to achieve what the rules are announcing rewards for, and the other is by trying to corrupt either the rules or the application of the rules. So you can also get rewarded by changing the rules in a way that is more favorable to yourself, or by influencing those who are applying the rules in a way that benefits you at the expense of your competitors. All right, so there's this general problem which I described, so that people have incentives or have ways of being rewarded in a competitive game when they influence the rules or their application. And that's a sort of general Achilles heel. This is what this little picture is supposed to be, an Achilles heel of competitive systems. It's a very general problem that you find in competitive systems of all sorts. Now, when this happens, when competitors are trying to influence the rules or trying to influence those who either write the rules or apply the rules, then, of course, these rules and their formulators and appliers themselves become objects of the competition, which is not what these competitive systems intend, if you like, which is not what makes them effective. Now, when this happens, then competitive systems can lose a lot of their effectiveness. And they lose their effectiveness in two main ways. One is that all the efforts that are invested in influencing the design of the rules or the application of the rules, all these efforts are lost to the system. To the extent that you invest in that effort, time, money, to that extent you're not investing efforts in providing good services or whatever the system is supposed to elicit. And secondly, insofar as these efforts actually succeed, insofar as you're actually influencing the rules or their application, the system itself tracks ever less well those outcomes that it is supposed to track. You are diverting then effort from the goals, the socially valuable goals that the system was supposed to serve. Now, you might think that moralization can stabilize the system to some extent. So if the players in the system have internalized a certain ethos, if they know what the system is supposed to promote and if they are committed to it, then that may stop them from trying to manipulate either the rules or the application of the rules. And this is something that you find in sports, for example, that people have a picture of the good athlete, the fair sportsman or sportswoman, who wouldn't dream of trying to cheat or trying to influence the referee, because as soon as you do that, you will lose your own chance of winning fair and square. But this sort of moralization can only function under certain favorable conditions. It ceases to be a promising avenue of protecting the system in situations where there are very, very large temptations, where enormous amounts of money are at stake. So I'm old enough to remember a time when tennis players would throw a ball into the net intentionally when the referee made a mistake in their own favor. So they would say, okay, the referee saw the ball, my ball in, it was really out, so I will give this ball back to my opponent by tossing the next ball into the net, and all is fair and square. You don't see this so often anymore today, at least in matches where a lot of money is at stake, because for players, winning versus losing at Wimbledon or whatever just means so much in terms of the advertising revenue that they can make and so on. It's just too much money at stake for players to continue with that practice. And once a significant minority of players stops living up to that practice, then you get the sucker exemption. Then people will say, why should I be the sucker? Why should I be the only one who gives back a ball? Who knows whether my opponent would be equally fair and equally nice if our roles were reversed? So I don't want to be taken advantage of. I don't want to be the one who is losing a game because of fairness when there's no assurance that other players are still playing by these rules. So a practice like this very quickly disintegrates. A further point that's especially relevant in the international competition is that there's a diversity of values, so that we might say, well, yeah, we are committed to this particular value, so we really feel that it is wrong to take advantage of opportunities to corrupt the rules or their application, but the people we are competing with, firms from Japan or from China or whatever, they don't, you know, maybe they have some sort of ethics, I don't know what it is, but certainly they don't have our ethics, and so it would be asking too much of me in my competition with these other players from other cultures to live up to my own ethical standards that perhaps I would be living up to if it were just within the UK. And further, there's also afoot a lot of dishonest moralization and demoralization of rules, so that when there is when there are rules that are seen as morally important, as ones that it would be morally wrong to breach, even in secret, then companies and strong players often try to demoralize those rules and try to say, well, actually, it's not so wrong to do this sort of thing. And so there's, for example, lawyers' ethics that now allows lawyers to do quite extensive efforts in behalf of their clients to get clients acquitted. And of course, the more lawyers are ethically free to do in the courtroom by way of discrediting an accuser, especially with sexual crimes and so on, the more lawyers are morally free to do in the courtroom, the more valuable lawyers become to people under accusation. And so the more money lawyers can ultimately earn. So there's a kind of self-interested reason for the profession of lawyers to expand by their own lawyers' ethics the liberties that they have in the courtroom as to what they might do. And conversely, there are also dishonest or somewhat corrupting efforts to moralize rules that really shouldn't be moral. A good example of that is intellectual property rights, where companies have fought a huge campaign to moralize issues that really aren't, when you think of it, all that morally exciting. So for example, people are listening to Madonna songs in China, and no, they haven't paid any money to the company that owns the rights to the song. They've just copied that. And then IP companies are starting to talk about piracy and about theft and so on, using very heavy moral language in order to moralize the rules that protect the intellectual property rights. Now, as soon as you live in a society in which these sorts of efforts, self-interested efforts to moralize rules and to demoralize rules are quite common, then the entire currency of morality gets devalued and people kind of say, well, how seriously should we really take these moral aspects of rules? And so this effort of protecting rules through moralization and of specific rules is then no longer very successful. Now, one thing that I think we find in the modern world is a good amount of regulatory capture, both in national systems and also in international systems, where the rule making is captured by the strongest people in the competition. So firms try very hard through what's called lobbying to influence any lawmaking efforts that affect themselves, of course, in their own favor. And they also lobby their own governments very hard in order to get their governments to weigh in international negotiations in their own favor. So this is a systemic problem of competitive systems, that these competitive systems can lead to regulatory capture with a spiral of increasing inequality, where the strongest players are likely to succeed in capturing the rules and influencing the rules in their own favor. That in turn strengthens them, makes them even stronger in comparison to weaker players, which in turn gives them even greater opportunities to influence the rules in their own favor, which in turn strengthens them, and so on. So inequality spirals can occur in this context. And here, players do not only influence politicians, but they also try to influence the media, they try to influence academics, especially our Homo economicus colleagues in the econ departments, who are often willing to write expert papers and so on how a particular set of rules would be advantageous to the country at large, where it's really advantageous just to the people who pay for the paper, and so on. So, and this phenomenon, this very well-known phenomenon of regulatory capture and so on, something that we see especially in the United States quite frequently and quite significantly, is, I think, especially relevant to this period of globalization. So in globalization, what globalization means, among many other things, is that many of the rules that govern our day-to-day transactions are shifted upwards from the national level to the global level. There may still be national rules, but even where they are, these national rules are heavily constrained by global rules. So states are losing some of their rule-making autonomy. For example, again, the intellectual property rights enshrined in the TRIPS agreement, they leave intellectual property protection to national legislation, but they very heavily constrain national legislation by prescribing that each country has to protect blah, blah, blah intellectual property. They have to do it with intellectual property rights that last at least 20 years. They have to grant product patents rather than process patents, and so on. So the leeway that states have gets restricted through international agreements. These international agreements, this enormous proliferation of international rules, is something that, of course, is in the first instance driven by states. It's states' representatives that get into these negotiations, that are negotiating these agreements. But, of course, there are a lot of people who are trying to lobby these states in order to have the agreements that they find advantageous for themselves. And the players who are able to engage in that sort of lobbying powerful states in order to get certain outcomes of international negotiations, those agents are not particularly many. These are large corporations, large industry associations, and maybe a few extremely rich individuals with personal access to people like Bill Clinton or George Bush or your prime minister and so on, who can get their views, get their interests represented in these international negotiations. These negotiations very often happen behind closed doors, so there's not a lot of transparency. There's not a real-time reporting on what various country delegations are putting forward in these negotiations or what draft texts there are. Normally, we get apprised of what countries have agreed upon at the end of the negotiations, where they publish a communique and then say, well, this is the text that we agreed upon. So for ordinary citizens, there's very little opportunity to weigh in, and even ex post, it's often very difficult to find out how this text exactly came about, who argued for what, which country delegation wanted a particular piece of language in the text, and so on. And that makes it all the easier for these very few privileged agents to lobby and influence the negotiations, because in the end, there's anonymity. In the end, it's not clear who was influenced by whom to push for particular outcomes. Now, if this is right, then globalization should be associated with an increase in inequality. So in democratic countries like this one, or the United States even, but mostly European countries, in democratic countries, there's a counterweight to the lobbying of corporations. First of all, it's much more transparent, namely people who want any kind of legislation adopted in the parliament, they'll have to formulate that legislation, they have to make it public, they have to propose it, and then the newspapers get access to it, it can be written about, you and I can read about it, we can weigh in on it, and so forth. And secondly, we also are in a much better position through at least our voting power to weigh in against it. So if a piece of legislation is strongly supported by certain industry associations but is strongly opposed by 85% of the British population, then a political party is hard-pressed to go for it because it would be politically dangerous for them to do so. They would have to pay a price at the next election if the legislation is important enough and so on. In international negotiations, all of these factors are absent. There's no transparency, there's no accountability, or much less of it, and there is also not the possibility for us democratically to somehow take countermeasures when we find that the text of international agreements isn't to our liking. So what I think is then happening is an increase in inequality that is partly explained by this phenomenon of globalization, and an inequality that is in one sense quite different from the inequality that we had in the history of humankind, which was very often correlated with such natural features of persons as their race, sex, or nationality, with their language or religion, their parental class, sexual preferences, whatever. So I think what we are seeing is a tendency towards ever greater inequalities, which are, however, removed from or disconnected from increasingly these sorts of natural features of persons. If that trend should continue, I think we can look forward to a future of increased inequality, certainly globally, but also in many nation states, which is, however, no longer strongly correlated with these various natural features of persons, and so is anonymized, as you might say, in that the people at the very top contain people of different races, different genders, different nationality, language, religion, and so forth. Now, to give you some empirical evidence that something like this is really happening, look at inequality in the United States, for example, where you have a pretty dramatic increase in inequality that began roughly with the beginning of the globalization period around 1980, which of course coincides also with the Republican takeover under Reagan. So, but start with the more immediate period, the economic expansion 2002 to 2007. We had a 16% increase in the per capita household income in the United States during that period. And if you disaggregate that, you find that the top 1% of the US population experienced growth of 62%, whereas the other 99% had 6.7% growth. So a very, very divided country, really two economies, one booming and the other, yeah, sort of having a little bit of a share of the growth, but not very much. So fully 65% of the entire growth in the US economy during that five-year period was captured by the top 1%. And lest you think that that is a brand new phenomenon, the Clinton expansion in the 1990s, similarly, 45% of the growth went to the top 1% of the population. Here's some more figures that show one further special feature of the inequality that has emerged in the last 20 years or so, namely that it is very, very top heavy, very heavily concentrated at the top. So this is a longer period from 78 to 2007. 78 was the year that where inequality in the United States bottomed. I'll say something about that in a moment. So that's why I picked 1978. And what happened since then is that we had a tremendous increase in inequality that was very heavily concentrated at the top. So the top 1% managed to increase its income share of national household income from roughly 9% to 23.5%, a 2.6-fold increase. The top 1/10 of 1% achieved a 4.6-fold increase. And the top 1/100 of 1%, we are now down to about 30,000 people in the US, achieved a 7-fold increase in its share of national household income. So these are very dramatic figures, and needless to say, figures that in the US are wholly unknown. I think outside the US probably also wholly unknown. But it's a very, very dramatic shift if you think about the US political system, which, as you know, works very heavily with money. A 7-fold increase where 30,000 people or 14,400 taxpayers suddenly have 6.04% of national household income. That's a very dramatic development and a very major change in what democracy means in the country. To put this in perspective, these 30,000 people have basically half as much income now as the bottom half of the country combined, the bottom 150 million people. So a tremendous inequality. This is what you find still in the older textbooks. I hope it's extinguished from the new one, the Kuznets curve, which says that inequality rises as a country develops, but please don't worry. This is normal. This is healthy. This is how it should be. It comes right back down as the country matures. And that's exactly what happened in the United States. It went up pretty dramatically to 1928, just before the Great Depression. It went down to 1978. And then, violating the textbook prescription, this good old inequality rose again to a level that is actually higher today than it was at the in the pre-Depression era. So we have a reversal and a very significant increase in inequality. Something similar is happening in China, the second most important country, maybe the most important at the end of the 21st century, where again we have a very dramatic increase in inequality that saw the share of the bottom half lose about 10% and the share of the top decile gaining about 10%. And in most countries in which we have figures, something quite similar has taken place over the globalization period, with one major example, a counterexample being France, and another one being Brazil. Brazil is not so exciting because, of course, their inequality had been very, very high to begin with, and partly through Lula's efforts, we have achieved a slight reduction in inequality. Tana, you know more, probably. Maybe not. So this is what's happening in the world at large. And again, these statistics are largely unknown, but very, very interesting. And what you see here is that, first of all, the top 5% of the world's population now has nearly half of global household income, 46.36%, nine times the average income in the world. The bottom quarter is reduced to a measly 0.75%, 1/32nd of the average income in the world. And so the spread or the ratio between the top 5% and the bottom quarter is fully 300-1. Pretty much all of you, if you look at your whole lives, belong to the top ventile, the top 5%. or which is roughly the same thing, the top third of the population of the developed countries. And so you all have as much income, at least again, not during your student days perhaps, but as much income as about 300 people among the people in the bottom quarter. So a pretty huge inequality. But the other thing that is worth looking at is this dramatic increase in inequality, which is again very top heavy. So the top ventile of all the 20 ventiles, the 20 20ths of the world's population, the only ventile that had meaningfully gained is the top ventile. They gained 3.5% of global household income over a 17-year period, and all the other ventiles either remained constant, like the second ventile, or lost ground. The bottom quarter lost the most ground. So the lower down you get, the more of a loss of ground there tends to be. And the bottom quarter lost fully one-third of its income share. So if you think of that, to make things easier, as a pizza, global household income as a big pizza, then what you get is, yes, the pizza increased in size, globalization increased the global product, but the angle, if you like, or the thickness of the slice of the pizza that goes to the bottom quarter increased, decreased from a ridiculously small 1.16% to an even more ridiculously small 0.78%. And you can imagine that if in a 17-year period you lose a third of the width of your pizza, then the increase in the total size of the pizza is not going to be able to compensate for that. So we have runaway inequality and one that benefits specifically the top 5% and hurts everybody else, and especially people in the bottom quarter and the bottom half. The bottom half now has less than 3% of global household income. The bottom quarter, basically just 0.75%. Now that also then leads, of course, to increasing poverty, as you see here in the figures from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, which document that the number of undernourished people has fallen pretty steadily until the early 90s and has then flattened out in percentage terms and increased in absolute terms. So the number of people that are chronically undernourished has been rising since the 90s and has broken above a billion for the first time in all of human history in 2009, and will repeat that feat probably this year with rising food prices. So again, the explanation on the superficial level is quite obvious. It is that inequality is rising fast, and especially the bottom quarter is losing ground very rapidly. Other poverty numbers, probably well known to many of you, are these ones here. So again, very, very massive deprivations continue for very large numbers of people. And this, again, is due, in the first instance, to the increasing inequality. You have roughly one-third of all deaths poverty-related. And this is a very conservative accounting, which counts only those deaths that are from causes that are essentially unknown in the rich countries. People in the poor countries die also from the same causes that we die from, like diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and so on. And they often die much earlier than we do because they have much worse medical care. But all those premature deaths I haven't counted. I've only counted those deaths that are from causes that are essentially non-existent in the developed countries. And even that amounts to about a third of all deaths in the world. If you put that in perspective and compare it to the main catastrophes of the 20th century, you can see that these 370 million poverty deaths in the last 20 years or so since the end of the Cold War quite clearly dwarf the catastrophes of the 20th century, in particular the 200 million people who died from government-sponsored violence of one sort or another, including wars, civil wars, gulags, concentration camps, and so forth. So it's about twice as many in just 20 years. Now, the explanation that I want to give, as I already indicated, has to do with globalization, and especially with that aspect of globalization that moves rules that determine and constrain and condition our ordinary interactions, that move these rules from the national level to the global level, and thereby make global negotiations highly relevant to the way in which our systems, in particular economic systems, are structured. So as I see it then, international law is divided against itself in that on the one hand, it is emphasizing all sorts of wonderful human rights. And of course, there's enormous progress since the Second World War in enshrining these human rights in international legal documents. We have tons and tons of human rights documents that many countries have signed and also ratified. And these documents are include paragraphs like this one. This is from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being, and so on. So that's something that is massively unfulfilled in the world as we have it today, as I showed you from the stats. And we also have the commitment, this is Article 28 of the same declaration, the commitment that these human rights should be constraints on the formulation of international rules. So it says here that everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. So again, we are committed in the Sunday portions of international law to taking human rights seriously and to designing all of international law in such a way that we reach a global order, an international order, in which the human rights of all human beings are secure. But then we have this other part of international law, much more consequential, much larger, literally millions of pages of documents, that is going in the opposite direction. So governments have created a very large system of economic rules that are not particularly well understood and not really controlled or controllable by the general public, that work towards increasing inequality and therefore towards the impoverishment of large segments of the human population. So these rules, I would say, violate human rights. So international law, if you look at it as a whole, is in that sense schizophrenic, that in one part of it, it is postulating all sorts of demands and high-sounding standards, which the other half of international law is then massively violating. Now, this sort of claim that our global rules are particularly important for understanding why inequality is increasing, why poverty is persisting, this claim is often opposed by people saying that it can't be true because so many countries are developing quite differently. So poverty is melting away in some countries. This used to be the Asian tigers. Now China is a big example of it. And in other countries, poverty is persisting. So there are very, very sharp differences in the way in which poverty develops over time. And these differences show quite conclusively that it can't be our global order that is responsible for the persistence of poverty where it persists. It must be local causes that are responsible for the persistence of poverty. Now, that is, on the one hand, a non sequitur in the sense that the mere fact that things are developing differently in different countries certainly shows that local factors or country-specific factors play a role, but it doesn't show that global factors play no role. And to show that with an example, if you have a class, let's say, that's being taught at a university, and at the end of the semester you find that students are performing very differently, that some students have learned a lot and other students have learned very little, you can certainly conclude from that there are differences among the students that explain, in part, the differences in learning success. But you cannot conclude from that the efforts of the teacher and the design of the classroom and the libraries and so on, all these global factors that affect all students are therefore irrelevant. And the teacher could be relevant in three different ways. The teacher could be relevant by improving, or the opposite, the performance of all the students. If the teacher had been better, all students would have done better. If the teacher had been worse, all of them would have done worse. Secondly, the teacher, in choosing teaching materials, a teaching style, and so on, can cater more to the needs and interests of some students than others, and therefore can be part of the explanation of why some students did better than others. And thirdly, the teacher may influence the very student-specific factors that then in turn account for differential learning success. So an example here would be a sexist teacher that may demotivate women students and thereby cause the differences among the students, that the women students are paying less attention than the male students, and therefore in the end learn less than the male students. But the ultimate explanation would not be that there's any kind of motivational deficit among the women students, but rather that the teacher, through his teaching style, demotivated the women students. Analogs to these three causal explanations, I think, also exist at the level of global institutional arrangements. So global institutional arrangements are relevant in these three different ways to the explanation of poverty. And I won't go into enormous detail because I've written this up at length in writings that maybe some of you already know. But basically, the things that I've analyzed with some care are these six different phenomena, these six different aspects of our global institutional architecture that are supposed to be examples of institutional arrangements in that non-Sunday part of international law, which play a major role in explaining the runaway inequality that we find and the continued impoverishment of the poor, the continuation of poverty. So I'll quickly run through them, or at least some of them, not all of them. Protectionism is probably the best known because there's a lot of opposition to protectionism even in rich countries. It's particularly prominent in agriculture, but also in textiles, where we still maintain various protectionist measures such as quotas, anti-dumping duties, and also very large subsidies to agricultural producers, which have the effect, on the one hand, of preventing imports into our countries from otherwise more effective, cheaper, low-cost producers from the developing world, and also make it harder for poor countries to export into world markets because our products are underselling them because they are artificially cheap. That is something that actually costs us money to support our agricultural producers. It saves a certain number of jobs, but it also loses many more jobs in developing countries where labor is cheaper and where production is more labor intensive than it saves in our countries. A second example are pollution rules. The rich countries are responsible for a large majority of pollution, and the rich countries are responsible for a large majority of the pollution in the world. And of course, much of the damage that this pollution does is visited upon the population in the poor countries, especially the poorest populations who are least able to protect themselves. Illicit financial flows. That's a topic that I got into recently. And here, the question is, or the problem is, that very large amounts of money are flowing from poor countries into rich countries, roughly $1 trillion a year. That is 10 times as much as all the development assistance taken together, even the nominal development assistance that rich countries give themselves credit for. And these illicit financial flows have many different components, of which the two most important are, first, the good old embezzlement, that public officials, rulers, and also small officials in developing countries are stealing money and are then parking that money in Western bank accounts. And here, I think our rules are very important in that we allow our banks to accept such deposits and even to keep these deposits secret, with some very minor exceptions. So in the US, for example, you can, if you're a bank, you can not accept money without reporting to the government, money that is related to drug dealing or to terrorism. But if your money is related, for example, to trafficking in women or children for sexual or other exploitation, then it's perfectly legal and perfectly all right for you to accept that money as a bank and not to report to the government your knowledge or suspicion about how that money was gained. Another larger component of these illicit financial flows are tax-avoiding monies. And that happens because a very large segment of international trade these days is trade within corporations, within different arms of multinational corporations. And here, corporations have a great deal of leeway as to where they pay their taxes. So, for example, if they produce in one developing country and sell in another developing country, they can ship the produce through a tax haven, sell it from the first developing country at a low price to the tax haven country arm, then sell it from there at a high price to the country where they want to sell it, thereby avoiding a profit in both the country of production and the country of consumption, and realizing a large profit in the tax haven in between, which could be the Cayman Islands or the Bermudas or something of that sort, Liechtenstein. So in these ways, of course, companies are willing to do that because the tax rates are lowest in the tax haven country. They pay their taxes there and thereby pay no taxes in the country where they have a lot of employees who are producing or in the country in which they have a lot of employees who are selling. So again, huge numbers of dollars, about $500 billion a year, are lost to poor countries each year through this sort of opportunity for trade mispricing. And that's, again, something that we could very easily do something about by requiring country-by-country reporting, that companies have to report not just their global profits and make sure that they show that they pay taxes on all their profits, but also their country-by-country profits with appropriate constraints on how they can price the products that they sell from one arm in one country to another. The four privileges are something that I analyzed some while ago. Basically, the phenomenon that we recognize any person or group exercising effective power in a country as entitled to sell us the resources of that country, to borrow money in the name of the people of the country, to sign internationally valid treaties in behalf of the country, and to purchase the weapons that they need often to stay in power. So we often say that the persistence of poverty in poor countries is due to the corruption that these governments and officials in these countries practice. And that's quite true, but it's also true that the amount of corruption and oppression couldn't be anywhere near as high if we didn't support it through these privileges, by granting these privileges to the effective rulers in these countries. So this is a phenomenon that corresponds to the sexist teacher, where you say, yes, it's true that there are demotivated women students, there are corrupt developing countries, but if you look more closely as to what drives that corruption or allows highly corrupt and highly oppressive regimes to maintain themselves in power, it's the fact that we recognize these regimes as entitled to sell the people's resources, as entitled to borrow money in the name of the people, as entitled to import weapons that they then can use to stay in power, and so on. And labor standards, I'll just skip. So the role of states is then that we have important supranational institutional arrangements that greatly aggravate inequality, as I tried to show, and also thereby aggravate poverty. And these rules are, in the first instance, under the control of governments. It's governments that are formulating these rules and governments that are adopting those rules and also enforcing these rules, upholding these rules, enforcing these rules against one another, and that are enforcing these rules or national versions of them domestically. These rules these international rules that are adopted by states and implemented by states are heavily influenced by corporate lobbying. And this corporate lobbying is something where these corporations, those in a position to influence the negotiations, of course, pay close attention to one another. They have often conflicting interests or competing interests. And so in influencing policy, influencing this rulemaking process, they have to make compromises. They have to concede things to one another. They have to accommodate each other in various ways. But they certainly don't have to pay a lot of attention to the poor. Now, I'm not suggesting that corporations or members of the global elite somehow hate the poor. They just don't particularly pay attention. They accommodate other strong parties in order to get these other parties to accommodate them. So if I am particularly interested in intellectual property rules, for example, I will be willing to let the car industry influence some other aspect of the global rule architecture in exchange for them letting me influence what's of particular importance to me, namely the intellectual property aspects of the global rule architecture. So they accommodate each other. And of course, the outcome, the predictable outcome of strong parties in their negotiations, in their joint lobbying efforts, making concessions to one another, is that they, on the whole, do better than those who are not in a position to lobby, and at the expense of those who are left in the cold, who are left on the outside. So the question then is, what can we do about this? If this is sort of, by and large, a correct diagnosis, then how can we shift the balance of forces in favor of the poor? Is this just a very bleak and pessimistic assessment that leaves us no options? Or is there something that morally motivated people can do in exploiting this analysis to make progress? Now, the way in which progress can be made, I think, is only by moral motivations combining with much stronger prudential motivations. So what's called for is a kind of judo where you use relatively weak forces that morality can muster in the world and try to thereby either rechannel or redirect much stronger prudential forces in favor of reform. Now, how to do that? One hopeful thought in this direction is that the existing system of pretty much a free-for-all for the strongest corporations and industry groups to design the international rules in their own favor, that's not an unmitigated blessing even to the strong who are in a position to lobby. And we saw that, I think, in the global financial crisis, that crisis was one that was costly even to many players in the global elite. And the problem is, or at least one explanation of the global financial crisis, is that it happened because of the incoherence in the global rule architecture. So you have the process that I just described. Different lobbying groups are each very fastened upon, very focused on a particular aspect of the international rule architecture. They're very eager to shape that in accordance with their own interests. And they're then willing to let other parts of the international rule architecture be shaped by other players who are especially interested in those other aspects in exchange for them allowing us to shape the aspect that we are particularly interested in. The outcome of that is a pretty incoherent system in which you have different aspects of the international rule architecture shaped by different interests, by different players. And that could easily lead to these instabilities like the global financial crisis. And here you have externalities where each player can, as this instability shows, has potentially more to lose from the rule shaping efforts, successful rule shaping efforts of others, than it has to gain from one's own rule shaping efforts. So arguably, and I'm not sure that that's true, but at least arguably, the lobbying opportunities that strong players have with regard to the international rules exemplify the structure of a collective action problem, where every player is better off being among those who can influence the rules, but all players would be better off if none of them had these influence opportunities than if all of them had them. At the very least, there are considerable costs involved in having these opportunities, or rather in all the strong players having these opportunities, and that might make strong players in a position to lobby more willing to give up these lobbying opportunities, because they're not only losing their own possibilities of lobbying, but also benefiting from other strong players no longer being able to lobby. So that's one hypothesis or hope, that even the rich or mighty, who are solely interested in protecting their own advantages, have at least some interest in the reduction of economic inequality, and thereby a reduction in their own, collectively speaking, lobbying or influencing opportunities. If it's true that in the long run they have to expect not only gains from their own lobbying efforts, but also losses from those by others. So a more democratic system, a more transparent system, that would lead to a more coherent global rule architecture might actually be in the interest even of strong players. And of course, it would be very much in the interest of the weaker players. Now, structural reforms, I think that those with an interest in moderating inequalities should try to focus on structural reforms rather than on trying to mitigate poverty here and there through one-off policies or measures. And what we should do is focus on those structural reforms that can also appeal to the generic interest in stability and can also appeal to specific interests in private gain. And I want to quickly conclude by giving an example of that in this health impact fund that Radar was kind enough already to mention, which exemplifies, I think, the six features that a successful structural reform should have. So a successful reform should be structural. It should be a permanent addition or permanent revision of the international or global institutional architecture. It should exemplify or symbolize the idea that all human lives are of equal value, that there is a moral point to the reform. It should benefit at least a faction of the global elite, maybe even all of them. It should be scalable so that you can start small and get to square one relatively easily, and can then, as you scale it up, also learn from experience and correct any mistakes that you find the proposal to have or the reform to have as you implement it. It should strengthen those with an objective interest in helping us achieve further reforms, in particular the poor. And it should also be replicable in the sense that it could be, if successful, also serve as a model for other structural reforms elsewhere. So the Health Impact Fund has these features. It's meant as a complement to the TRIPS agreement, a complement to the conventional way of rewarding new pharmaceuticals by allowing the inventor firm to increase the price of the pharmaceuticals to any level they like, basically giving them a temporary monopoly through a patent. It is a complement that is voluntary, so firms can register any product that they have, and if they register, they can get health impact rewards conditioned on the global health impact of their new medicine. So for 10 years, they participate in reward pools that are divided among registered innovators in proportion to their global health impact. It would be funded by willing governments to the tune of about $6 billion per annum, with governments putting in maybe 0.03% of their gross national income, accounting for the fact that initially, at least, only some governments will participate and not all. And it requires from registrants, those who register their products, that they sell the product at cost. That is to say, they put it out for tender, get the cheapest manufacturing bid, and then sell it at the cheapest feasible price of production. So that's basically the Health Impact Fund idea. it's scalable in that it can start at $6 billion and then be scaled up to larger amounts by additional countries joining the partnership or existing countries going beyond the 0.03% of GNI. And it's also replicable in that if it works reasonably well, it could be transferred to seeds, to green technologies, and so on, to those other areas where intellectual property rights and the resulting high monopoly prices also constitute a significant barrier to the diffusion of important innovations. Thank you.